here and now. From spying on Americans to torture and the rights for Guantanamo Bay detainees, Bush administration policies in the war on terror came under intense fire on Capitol Hill today as Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez testified before the Senate Judiciary Committee. Former Chairman Arlen Specter said he himself and other Republicans paid a political price for some of the choices the administration has made. New Chair Democrat Patrick Leahy grilled the Attorney General about whether the president used a signing statement to override law and allow Americans' mail to be opened. Here's Gonzalez's reply.
As far as I know, there is no ongoing physical searches of mail under the authorization used.
And there hasn't been?
And there, to my knowledge, there hasn't been any kind of authorization.
Would you know if there was?
I suspect that I would know, sir. Yes, sir.
Well, then why in heaven's name did the president feel he needed to issue a signing statement?
Well, joining us on the line from Capitol Hill with more on this somewhat testy hearing today is Dimitri Sevastopoulou, Pentagon and intelligence correspondent for the Financial Times. And Dimitri, Gonzalez was grilled on a range of issues, but let's start with the mail question. How did Alberto Gonzalez reply further when asked about why the president wanted the authority to open mail?
Well, Gonzalez said that essentially the signing statements, which are these statements that are appended to legislation when the president signs it, have been used from presidents from, you know, a couple of hundred years ago all the way through Bill Clinton and now by President Bush. He was asked why President Bush felt the need to do this on a postal reform bill, which seemed to be completely unrelated to any attempts to spy on citizens. And he said this was a kind of a pro forma. The president just wanted to make clear that he had the inherent authority under legislation to do certain things. But I think the senators were very skeptical, and at times during the hearing it felt like it was a little boy being admonished by his teachers, both Specter and Leahy, the top Republican and Democrat.
In particular because President Bush has used these signing statements more than any other president. But the senators also had questions about yesterday's news that the Bush administration will now allow a secret panel of judges known as the FISA Court to oversee the program of secret wiretapping of international communications in terrorism cases. This is a U-turn for the Bush administration, but we understand that it was revealed today that apparently the administration has been negotiating this for quite some time after a court order.
Well, this is one of the interesting questions. The administration says that it has been trying to negotiate with the Secret Intelligence Court before the emergence of this, before the details of this program were revealed in December 2005, I believe it was. And then the question is, then why did they not tell the Judiciary Committee and the Intelligence Committee they were doing this last year when there was such a kind of public furore over what was happening? And Alberto Gonzalez didn't have a clear answer for that today, and I think there's going to be more questions, especially from Senator Specter on this.
We'll stay with that moment for a moment because it seemed pretty extraordinary. Arlen Specter, very angry, finding out that Gonzalez had been working on oversight for a year and a half without him when he was chair. Mm-hmm. He talked about getting a form letter from a low-level Justice Department employee after talking personally with the president. Tell us more about that moment.
Well, he was angry on a number of issues. He was angry, first of all, because a response to questions that he had submitted to the Justice Department came back in, I think he said, 176-page letter, and that even he as a speed reader couldn't finish it before the hearing started this morning. He was very aggressive with Alberto Gonzalez. I think that they feel that they've been kept in the dark initially on the program. And then now they feel if the administration was making a good faith effort to bring the program under the law, as critics have argued they needed to do, then why did the administration not make that clear to congressional committees that were responsible for oversight?
And before we let you go, we want to touch on an exchange with Massachusetts Senator Ted Kennedy. He asked about Iraq, whether Congress had the authority to limit the scope of the war. But he also asked about Iran and whether the president needed congressional authority to invade Iran. What did Gonzalez say in response?
Here he was very interesting, but quite ambiguous. He said both on the case of Iraq and Iran that Congress had a role to play in any decision to launch an invasion or invade a country. But he hinted that under certain circumstances, for example, if it was necessary in the defense of the U.S., if the U.S. was attacked by Iran, that it might be possible that the president would have the authority to hit back at Iran. But he didn't make clear what those circumstances would be. Would they be a direct attack on the U.S. on U.S. soil? Would it be an attack on U.S. troops in Iraq, which is something that the administration has been very critical of in recent months? But he left it very ambiguous, and I think there are going to be a lot more questions about Iran in the coming days.
Well, it sounds as if, just in the few seconds we have, I mean, how would you characterize today? It sounds as if there's a sort of a collision course being set up.
Well, certainly Spector and Leahy were incredibly aggressive. I think, aside from that, it basically broke down on party lines. Most of the other Republicans who were there were very complimentary about Alberto Gonzalez, saying that he had one of the hardest jobs in the history of the Justice Department. But the Democrats now hold the gavel. I think they're going to push very aggressively on all of these issues, on renditions, on Guantanamo Bay, and there'll be lots of fireworks ahead, I suspect.
Dimitri Savastopoulos, Pentagon and intelligence correspondent for the Financial Times. Thanks, as always.
Thanks, Robin.
Help wanted. The U.S. is expected to be short more than 800,000 nurses when some 80 million baby boomers retire over the next decade. So, what to do? Well, nurses and hospitals are hoping the new Congress will respond to the shortage with more funding for nursing programs, because according to the Department of Labor, nursing is the second fastest growing occupation in the U.S. Applications to nursing schools are up 40%. But in 2005, 147,000 qualified applicants were turned away from these programs because of a shortage of nursing faculty. Well, we're going to spend some time today on the nursing shortage. We start with Mary Jane Williams, a nurse educator at the University of Hartford and a lobbyist for the Connecticut Nurses Association. She joins us from the studios of Connecticut Public Radio in Hartford. Mary Jane, welcome.
Thank you. Welcome.
Let's talk about that faculty shortage first. For instance, in Connecticut, can you draw a bead on that? Can you tell us an equation that illustrates that? You know, do you have more applicants than you have teachers for them?
Absolutely. Every nursing program in the state of Connecticut has a waiting list of qualified applicants. And one of our community college programs runs a waiting list of up to 500 students a year.
Oh.
And uses a lottery system for admission. And so what happens when you have this qualified waiting list, when they don't get into a nursing program as quickly as they like to, they go into other fields. So
sure.
We're losing this whole qualified applicant pool to other fields. And we're suffering in the fact that we're not graduating the numbers of nurses that we project we'll need in the next 10 to 15 years.
That's right. Well, so why isn't there enough faculty? Why is there such a long waiting list?
Well, in the state of Connecticut, we think there's a couple of problems that are occurring that add to the issue. Number one is we graduate 53% of our nurses from associate degree programs. An associate degree is a 2-year technical degree. And most associate degree education occurs in community college settings. And bachelor's of science graduate from a BSN program in a 4-year college is considered to be an RN and is licensed at the same level as an associate degree nurse. And that is nationally. So as long as you're educated in either an associate degree or a bachelor's program, you come out with the same licensure.
And in order to become a teacher and go on to be a faculty member, which is the shortage we're talking about, well, they're that much farther away from that.
That's right. And you need a master's degree as a basic entry for a faculty position in this state, according to our regulations. And so the baccalaureate people need to move into master's education. And only about 9% of all baccalaureate graduates of the state of Connecticut move into master's education.
Right.
That's a bottleneck for us.
Right. And we understand as well that once nurses do get into teaching faculty positions, they make so much less than other professionals. It's not as much of a draw. Tell us about that.
Nationally, the mean salary for a master's prepared advanced practice nurse is $72,000. The mean salary for a master's prepared nurse educator is $55,000. So nurses who have master's degrees can stay within a service sector, a hospital or a community, and make a much better salary.
How much can nurses make, top dollar?
Oh, top dollar, I would say between $90,000 and $100,000.
Huh. So why would they be motivated to be a faculty member if they'd only make 50 to 75?
I think we absolutely need to pay nurse faculty members a more equitable salary. And we need to come up with innovative ways to partner with hospital institutions in order to maybe accomplish that goal within the state of Connecticut.
So there aren't enough nurse faculty now, not just in Connecticut, but across the country. And a new study
right.
from the National League of Nurses shows that it's going to get worse. 50% of the nursing faculty now says they're going to retire within the next 10 years.
That's absolutely true, because the largest population of nurse faculty are 55 and older. Most faculty who are prepared at the doctoral level never obtain their PhD degree until they're 48 years old. So that whole workforce is on the older side and retiring sooner. And so many baby boomers who are getting ready to retire who are faculty, we will be losing close to 50% of our faculty in the next few years.
Well, let's talk about what some of the possible solutions are. We mentioned a new Democratic Congress, which talks a lot about health care. I read an unbelievable statistic that the amount of money appropriated now for, you know, federally funded nursing programs and the education and recruitment of nursing is a quarter of the appropriations of 1974.
Absolutely.
That's amazing. It's so little.
In 1974, we got $153 million for nurse education. And this year, the Congress appropriated $149 million. It was actually less. The final figure, we begged for $175. Every single group testified. So we're getting less as education costs increase. And so in a way, that's going to hamper the preparation of nurse educators. The states are doing a better job at getting money into their schools of nursing. And organizations are doing a better job at getting money into faculty education. But the federal government has not put the needed dollars. We should be getting about $500 million a year at a minimum into workforce development, and part of that being education.
Well, let me actually play devil's advocate. Some would say, well, why should the federal government do this? Why shouldn't it be states and privately owned hospitals who would pay to boost their own and recruit their own staff?
Well, that's a really complex question, but I think the federal government has a responsibility to make sure that we have the health care workforce that we need in order to keep the public healthy. And if you do not have nurses, then you do not have a healthy public. We have 2.9 million nurses. The research that's coming out supports the fact that if you do not have nurses, professional nurses, providing care, you have higher mortality and morbidity, and you have more complications. So without the nursing workforce, without the healthcare providers, the federal government, in a way, will be paying for more healthcare, more Social Security disability. Nursing is actually the key person, the key people in the healthcare system.
That's Mary Jane Williams, a nurse educator on the nursing shortage. We'll take a break, and just ahead, how does popular culture view nurses?
4B's got post-op pneumonia. Let's start antibiotics.
Are you sure that's the right diagnosis?
Well, I don't know. I'm only an intern. Here's an idea. Why don't you go spend 4 years in med school and then let me know if it's the right diagnosis? God, I hate nurses.
She may not have pneumonia, you know. She could be splinting or have a PE.
Like I said, I hate nurses.
What did you just say? Did you just call me a nurse?
A clip from Grey's Anatomy, which raises the question, why has everyone on TV shows suddenly become a doctor? More ahead here and now. Robin Young, it's Here and Now. We're back with more on the nursing shortage and also take a look at how nurses are portrayed in the media. We're joined again by nurse educator and lobbyist Mary Jane Williams of the University of Hartford in Connecticut. Welcome back.
Thank you.
And we're also joined now by Suzanne Gordon, author of Nursing Against the Odds and a past guest here on Here and Now. And Suzanne, welcome to you as well. And I want to ask you, just what's your overarching concern about the image of nurses?
Well, I think that the media image of nurses doesn't convey their importance to hospitals, to other healthcare institutions, and patients. And the image is either completely ludicrous, where nurses are completely invisible and just sort of simply not there, and the doctors do the nursing work like on Grey's Anatomy, or it's very sentimentalized.
Well, let's take a listen. To cultivate nurses into the profession, corporations have put millions of dollars into recruitment campaigns. Let's listen to one.
There are some who live for caring with all they have to give. There are some who have comfort to share. They dare to care. They dare to cry.
Suzanne Gordon, your thoughts.
Well, this is something I've written a lot about, and basically this is the complete sentimentalization and trivialization of nursing. I mean, the reason why you want a nurse at your bedside is not to cry with you or to pat you on the head. It's because if you don't have a nurse at your bedside, you know, you're going to die. You're going to get a preventable complication. You're going to get a urinary tract infection. You're going to develop a blood clot in your leg. You know, you're going to get the wrong medication, and nobody's going to be there who knows that that is the wrong medication, and so forth. And if you pull people into the profession on the basis of this kind of sentimental, angelic image of nursing, people are going to be real surprised when they get into nursing, wherever they do nursing, because it ain't like that.
Well, you know, Mary Jane, I want to ask you, Suzanne says nurses, you know, save lives, and polls show that people feel that nurses do save their lives, and that a shortage of nurses, that they feel that shortage, and it endangers them. Statistically, though, can you prove that a nurse does save lives?
Absolutely. I think Linda Aiken's work out of the University of Pennsylvania addresses that. She found that as the workforce had the lower level of educated nurse versus the higher level of educated nurse, that there was higher mortality and morbidity. She found that nurse staffing patterns affected the patient outcomes. And I think as a nurse who worked in critical care for years, I can definitely say that there is research that supports the fact that the nurse is the critical component in the provision of health care, in the assessment and the diagnosis of the patient who is critically ill, in the treatment of that patient in those settings.
You've been a nurse in 64. Tell us how maybe your job changed, but maybe the way a person views a nurse hasn't.
When I graduated in 1964, we took care of severely ill patients, but the level of illness has changed. Patients are living longer. They're older. They have multiple complications. They have multiple system failure. We have technology that keeps them alive. And the nurse has to have a broad depth and breadth of education, because the patients that she's taking care of, or he are taken care of, are critically ill. The other thing is, I always joke about this with my students, is that when I took care of patients, we had patients that were considered up and about. A patient today is in the hospital for a very short span of time, and during that span of time, we're taking care of their acute needs. We move those patients out to either short-term rehab, long-term care, or the community in very, very rapid time span, so that the nurse who is in a hospital in an acute care setting is simply working the hardest with the most severely ill patients that they possibly could handle.
Well, and that brings us to this disconnect, though, this perception problem. And we started off by talking about the media presentation of nurses. There's a website, Suzanne, where nurses themselves actually rate television shows. We talked about Grey's Anatomy. There's House, ER. What are they saying on the website?
It's the Center for Nursing Advocacy, and they look at all the media presentations of nursing, including some of the corporate campaigns, and they look at whether there's really an accurate depiction of nursing, and they find that very often there isn't. In the corporate campaign, for example, that you mentioned in Grey's Anatomy and the ER, they've launched different campaigns against these, against ads in Skechers had an ad, you know, where they had this kind of naughty nurse with Christina Aguilera with short pants and you know, bosom coming out of her white starched uniform and so forth. And they actually campaigned against that and got that ad pulled. And you see that there's a lot of action on the part of nurses attacking these shows. But the problem is that there isn't a lot of change in these shows and in this media image. I mean, you see the same thing in newspapers. There's very little inclusion of nurses in all the kinds of stories we see about the medical miracle, you know, saving Christopher Reeve, you know, the 13-hour surgery, separating the Siamese twins. And it's as though they're in the operating room for 14 hours and then they somehow miraculously leave the hospital. Well, something happened, I mean, in between the time they got out of the operating room and they left the hospital, if they made it alive, and that something that happened was nursing.
Well, so what happens now? Media problems, but we began the conversation by noting the huge nursing shortage and the shortage specifically of faculty members to teach them.
Well, we need more money. I mean, you know, we need more money in nursing education. I mean, at the same time as we have a shortage of money, dollars going into nursing education, Congress several years ago gave something like almost $300 million to pediatric residency programs in something like, I don't know, 200 American hospitals when there's no shortage of pediatricians. And, you know, as Mary Jane said, you know, they're shortchanging nurses, giving them exactly what they had in less than what they had in 1974. So we need more money, and they're right to demand it because nurses deserve it.
That's Suzanne Gordon. She's author of Nursing Against the Odds. We've also been talking to a nurse educator and lobbyist, Mary Jane Williams, at the University of Hartford, about the nursing crisis. More than 800,000 nurses are going to be needed when some 80 million baby boomers retire over the next decade, and there's just not enough people to teach them. Both of you, thanks so much for talking to us about this today.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
And for more on the nursing crisis, go to our website, here-now.org. Well, quick note, tomorrow on Here and Now, what did the Democratic Congress accomplish in its 100 hours of hearings and legislation? We'll take a look. And also we'll talk Oscar picks with Renee Graham, who says it has to be Martin Scorsese's year. Will it be? Stay with us. More ahead, Here and Now. Funding for It's Here and Now. Why did the U.S. allow oil companies to skip out on about $1 billion in government royalty payments at a time when big oil was reaping record profits? That was the focus of a Senate Energy Committee hearing today. An apparent bureaucratic blunder dating back to the Clinton administration allowed the companies to avoid royalty payments for drilling oil and gas in federal waters. Also today, the House is expected to pass an energy bill that would raise about $14 billion over 10 years by repealing tax breaks to oil companies and closing that loophole on royalty payments. Well, this is the last of six bills Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi promised to pass in the first 100 hours of the new session. To learn more about it, we go to Edmund Andrews of the New York Times, who first broke the story on the missed royalty payments of last year. Ed, welcome.
Thank you, Robin.
And first of all, let's talk about those missed royalty payments. How is it that these oil companies avoided making them?
Well, it's a story that is kind of boring and shocking at the same time. What happened was Congress passed legislation in the 90s saying that companies that drilled in very deep waters in the Gulf of Mexico should be allowed to escape their royalties for a certain initial part of what they produced, and that was an incentive to get them to drill in very high-cost, high-risk areas.
And
that was fine, but what happened was for 2 years in 1998 and 1999, the Interior Department got a little mixed up. And this is under the Clinton administration. Mm-hmm. They literally got mixed up, and they left out a key clause that everybody thought was a part of the program.
And it's standard.
It's a very standard clause. It was, you know, always part of the thinking in Congress, and it was, and it had been, you know, part of the leases before and after. But in those 2 years, they dropped this clause that said you don't get this special incentive if oil prices climb above about $34 a barrel.
Which happened a long time ago.
Yeah, it happened about 3 years ago.
Right.
And what is more stunning is that the mistake was noticed at some mid-level bureaucratic level in 2000. At that time, it didn't mean anything in practical terms because prices were still below that cutoff point. But anyway, nobody talked about it. They fixed the leases going forward, but They didn't fix the leases from those 2 years, and nobody discussed it, nobody tried to address it until 2006, when frankly I wrote a story that sort of ran through these calculations of what they thought they were going to be losing.
Well, I just want to hold you up a second there, because I want to make sure we've got this chronology correct. So the initial mistake was made in the 98-99?
That is correct.
Right. And it was first noticed when?
It was first noticed in 2000. And so what they did, and this was supposedly done at sort of a career staff level, they stopped making that mistake in the leases signed in 2000 and going forward.
Well, but then you also report this week that the Interior Department, Interior Department's Inspector General uncovered information showing that the Bush Interior Department also realized this mistake 3 years ago.
Right. It was sort of not discussed, kept under wraps. But in 2004, what happened was oil prices suddenly had climbed through these cutoff points, these price thresholds. And so oil companies were asking them, you know, what's the deal here? Do we or do we not get the royalty relief? And they had to actually say something to the companies. And at that point, they did, but in a very quiet way. And it turns out that that senior people did alert the director of the Minerals Management Service at that time that this is going on, and they had no choice. They were going to have to, you know, let them get away with it. But all of this stuff stayed way below the surface, and the director, and she's still with the Minerals Management Service, told Congress last September that she first heard about it in 2006, basically when my story came out. Now she's recanted a bit and said, well, she must have known in 2004, but she didn't give it much thought at the time.
Well, the Inspector General is calling it a jaw-dropping example of bureaucratic bungling. But lay out for us, if it was corrected going forward, where were the royalties lost and how much was lost to the government?
Well, they estimate that about $1 billion has been lost so far. The thing you have to understand is that with this deep water drilling, the lag times are very, very long. So only a small portion of the these leases is actually producing yet. It takes years to do the exploration and then to do the actual setup of the full, you know, production operation out there in you know, sometimes in thousands of feet of water. So this stuff is just beginning to come online. So what they're saying is we know we've lost about $1 billion already, and we look to lose about $10 billion. And time frames vary, but something over the next 5 years to 10 years.
Well, as we mentioned, House Democrats expect to pass a bill today which cracks down on the oil industry and addresses this problem. So, first of all, how does it address this problem, and then what else does it call for?
Well, what the bill does is it says, okay, the leases are valid as such, but any company that refuses to renegotiate with the Interior Department and give up that loophole will either be slapped with a hefty, quote, conservation fee, unquote, $9 a barrel for every barrel of oil they produce, or they will not be allowed to acquire any additional leases in the Gulf of Mexico or in Alaska or wherever. And those are two very, very stiff penalties. Actually, not being able to get future leases in the, would be a really big blow to oil companies. Mm-hmm. So that's their approach, and they're saying we're not saying you have to renegotiate. We're just saying that if you don't, we're not going to do business with you anymore. We're going to tax you. Some Republicans and the industry argue vehemently, and the Bush administration, that this is unfair. These companies signed legitimate contracts. We have to respect the sanctity of contracts, and so even if they were bungled, it's not the company's fault that the government made a mistake. And it is pretty much agreed it was the government's mistake. In fact, Chevron officials say that they actually called attention to the issue in 2000 to a lower level person, and it just kind of got ignored. So it wasn't the company's fault, but the other side of that is that at the time, the companies also thought that they had this restriction. They assumed that restriction was in place. They didn't realize, for the most part, that this loophole existed until much later.
So it's hard for them to cry foul. Well, we understand in just about the minute we have that the measure is expected to pass the House, but as you said, it might face a tough time in the Senate and at the White House. Do you think it will pass ultimately, Ed?
I think so. I really do think it will. I think the patience in both parties is running very low, and I don't think the White House is going to put up a big fight about it.
Ed Andrews of the New York Times speaking about efforts in Congress to crack down on oil companies that have been avoiding billions of dollars in royalty payments to the U.S. government, even if they didn't know it. Ed, thanks so much, and we'll ask you to help us stay on top of this. Thank you.
My pleasure. Thanks a lot.
Stay with us. More ahead, here and now. By day, they negotiate national security and oil prices. By night, they argue over who ate my cereal or whether someone left the tub unscrubbed. Welcome to 127 D Street, where Senators Charles Schumer and Dick Durbin share a crash pad with Representatives George Miller and Bill Delahunt, all Democrats, and all featured in today's Boston Globe and New York Times. Congressman Delahunt joins us on the line. And Congressman, what were you thinking letting a reporter into your house?
Oh, we all make mistakes, Robin.
There's a story today in both the Boston Globe and the New York Times. It was sort of open house at Animal House, if you will, a story about your home at D Street. Now, how would you describe this? It's a brownstone, isn't it?
How would I describe it?
Yeah.
A hovel. You know, a slum.
Well, it actually could be quite nice. It's a home that we should say is owned by Congressman George Miller of California. He rents it to you guys. He sort of resents some of the depictions. Are those?
We wanted to expose Miller for what he really is.
For the landlord he is?
You know, he proclaims to be a progressive, someone concerned about people and how we're all in this together. And he's got the nicest room.
Well, you are.
And I have to sleep in the living room with Chuck Schumer.
I was going to say, you are all sort of in it together on pull-out beds and yeah. With sheets thrown over the windows in some of these images we're seeing. Am I looking at sort of a whole bunch of right guard tubes next to the kitchen phone on the kitchen sink?
Yes, you are.
Because?
They've been there quite a while, actually. You know, they're used sparingly because, in my case, I run to the gym as soon as I wake up, so I can shower and clean up.
Is that also because Chuck Schumer doesn't clean out the bathtub after he uses it?
That's one of the problems. And then, as you probably noted, we have another problem. It's called rats.
Is it true?
These are not small rats. I tackled one of those rats. It was, I don't know, maybe 2 or 3 feet long. But I prevailed.
We should say that Congressman Miller also objects to the thinking that there are rats in the home that he rents to you guys. But apparently Dick Durbin, Majority Whip, catches them with his bare hands.
He is very quick. If he wasn't the Majority Whip in the U.S. Senate, he could play NBA basketball. Schumer, on the other hand, has quick feet because when the rats invade, he jumps up on his bed and starts to tremble.
As we've said, Dick Durbin is the Senate Majority Whip. Charles Schumer is third in Senate leadership. George Miller heads the House Education and Labor Committee, and you are now chair of the Foreign Affairs Subcommittee on Investigations and Oversight. People think that people with those titles, you know, have a better living space than we're seeing here. What would you tell those people about, you know, why you are living this way?
Well, you know, actually, it's a lot of fun. You know, there's a degree of camaraderie that help each one of us sometimes get through some difficult days down here. And it's a touch of home. It really is.
Oh, well, well that's too bad.
Yeah, I know.
Well,
you can see where we came from.
Well, but that is the point, that you have to maintain homes in Washington and in the state you represent. That can get expensive.
It actually does get expensive. But I've always sensed that there's perception that members come down to Washington and live in elegant surroundings, and there is a great disparity between the reality and perception.
And the myth.
You know what? It's worth it. We all enjoy profoundly what we do.
Just to tick through a few things, is it true that the fridge pretty much contains grapes and beer?
That might even be an exaggeration. the grapes don't last very long.
And just before we let you go, it seems as if you have the problem that people who share apartments everywhere have had. Someone buys a cereal and everyone else eats it.
Yeah, that's the way it is. But, you know, I would never say that our cupboard is overstocked. And somehow we've all managed to put on weight. So that's a mystery.
Congressman William Delahunt, who's also chair of the Foreign Affairs Subcommittee on Investigations and Oversight, he has the fold-out in the living room. Congressman Delahunt, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Robin, thank you.
And to read reporter Alex Beam's Boston Globe story and see pictures of the apartment, go to our website, here-now.org. More ahead here and now. It's Here and Now. To dive into the music of Finnish group Vartina is to enter an often dark world. Songs featuring the harmonies of Vartina's three female singers and a smorgasbord of instruments played by the men in the group. Their latest CD, Miro. This track is Maria, a call to a woman from the underworld lost in the moors. Last year, Vartina co-wrote the score to the Toronto stage production of the musical Lord of the Rings, fitting because Tolkien based his tale on a 19th century epic poem from Finnish folklore. Vartina will soon work on the revised London production, which opens in June, and they're currently touring the U.S. Two of the group's members join us now from the NPR studios in Washington. We welcome Mari Karsinen.
Kiitos. Thank you.
Yeah.
Kiitos, that's thank you.
And Janne Lopelainen.
Thanks.
And we appreciate you both being here. I want to ask you first about the lyrics. I throw off sparks. I tear from my tongue words as twisted as tree roots. I poke the fire of hatred with my words. I hurl hate back at you. This is very dark.
Yeah, it sounds quite bad. I know. Yes, it tells about situation when you are very angry.
I guess so.
Then you feel that those snakes are in your head, and they are doing.
My loathing drips blood. My pain slashes, curses, drenches with pus. You know, you rarely hear the word pus in pop songs here in the U.S. Janne, was it always like this? This kind of graphic, almost gothic language.
Well, it hasn't been always like that, but I think we have done lots of really happy and nice songs. So it's good to do something a little bit different.
Well, those are the words. But Mari, in the music itself, am I hearing a little of, it almost sounds like the Bulgarian women's choir, those tight, tight harmonies of the Bulgarian women's choir that was so popular, that burst on the scene in the 50s and 60s?
There might be something, yes, because we love those Bulgarian things and those harmonies which we are using. They are also related.
I understand the musical tradition, though, that you're closest to is the Finnish Karelian. Is that, am I saying that correctly? Karelian tradition?
Karelian, yeah.
What is that?
That's area which is nowadays situated in Russia. And it has been really rich area in terms of music and poetry. We are living in Karelia, but it's in Finnish side.
How would you define Karelian tradition?
Well, it has some Russian influences, but also these really Eastern influences, like these close-up harmonies, for example. They are quite signature style for that.
Yeah. How much does your native Finland's geography also contribute to your sound? We know that there's a dark time of year, people hunkering down indoors. How much does that also contribute to the sound?
Of course, it affects, because that's part of our lives. So wintertime is really dark and kind of depressing. And then when summer comes, the sun doesn't go down. We party all the time. So it's kind
happy.
Of winter is for sleeping and summer is for having fun.
Right.
Well, and winter is for yearning. Let's listen to the song. Is it Lupos?
Yeah.
Lupos. This is The Promise. It's a love ballad. Let's listen to it a little. Mari, what are the words of this song?
It's some kind of traveling song. It's about traveling and being away from home.
I've gone beyond the seas, from the countries where I travel. The winds wouldn't reach my love in a day. No bird flies there in 2 days. It's quite a bit of yearning. Waves come between us. The ocean's expanse separates us. Well, as we mentioned, the group co-wrote the score from the musical of Lord of the Rings, which ran in Toronto. It was a hugely complex 3.5-hour production. It didn't do very well, and it's being rejiggered for a London production.
why would you ever take this up? Because all of the films have scores that people, you know, love and know and equate with the images.
Well, movie scores are a totally different thing than writing for theater, because some of the music is performed by the characters who are on stage.
Ah.
So in a way, the music has to be real. Whereas when you have movie score, it's kind of telling the story or underlining it, but it's not the real thing.
Right.
So they are different worlds.
What do you think went wrong with the production, which, as I said, is being restaged in London?
I don't think it was a disaster. I really enjoyed the show, and I saw more than 50 performances, and I loved it. But of course, people are really critical when it comes to Tolkien, because you have all these great movies,
right,
which have been a big success.
Right.
So of course, expectations are really high. But I'm sure that we will succeed better in London.
That's Mari Kasanen and Jani Lapalainen of the Finnish band Vartina. For more on their tour and the upcoming London stage production of Lord of the Rings, go to our website, here-now.org. And finally, this appreciation. Columnist Art Buchwald has died at the age of 81, and this time he really is gone. Last year, Buchwald moved to a hospice and refused further dialysis treatment for failing kidneys. Doctors amputated one leg, and friends rallied to say goodbye. But then, as Buchwald later said, he became the man who wouldn't die. He left his bed, went home, and wrote a book called Too Soon to Say Goodbye. Well, I first said hello to Art Buchwald 30 years ago. He was the unofficial tour guide of Martha's Vineyard, and I will always picture him, umbrella in hand, leading a drenched and bewildered, fog-encased group of Japanese tourists in the pouring rain. They could not understand him or see anything, and he didn't care. We said goodbye on Here and Now, part of Buchwald's carpe diem-like last round of interviews.
Well, I made my decision to not take dialysis. That meant I could relax because I'm going to die, so I don't have to make any plans. Then what happened is when I didn't die, I had to make plans. I had to shave again, and I had to deal with Bush again. When I agreed not to go to heaven, it was a whole different ballgame. I said, well, if I can't go to heaven, I'll go to Martha's Vineyard.
Sort of the same, some would say.
And Martha's Vineyard is some sort of heaven.
We understand that a lot of people came to see you in the hospice, and I'm just wondering if it reminded you of how much you're loved and maybe too soon to
go. Yeah, isn't that great? I could actually get all this love and still hear it and feel it.
Right.
If I was dead, I wouldn't get all that.
We understand that in the book you're including eulogies that were written but not delivered.
That's right.
From who?
My daughter, my son, and Mike Wallace, and Tom Brokaw. It was going to be a funeral, and now it's a celebration.
Well, I'm just personally glad we had a chance to say hi.
Yeah, let's say hi again.
Okay.
Goodbye, sweetheart.
Take care. Art Buchwald, who finally succumbed to kidney failure yesterday at 81. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.